The following story involves references to sexual violence. I don't want to trigger anybody. If you prefer, skip ahead a couple minutes and you'll be in the clear. In telling this story recently, I inadvertently did trigger somebody, hence the warning now. Seeing the blood rush from their face and mouth fall agape was a horrible moment to witness. The feeling was even worse because I was responsible for it. Many years ago, before I was even a playwright, I read a news article that stunned me. It involved a group of teenagers in Orange County, California, a video camera, and a rape. This was in the early 2000s when the subject of sexual violence didn't occupy the space it does in our culture today. I hadn't seen many of these stories. Perhaps that was because they weren't being reported, or maybe it was because of my own naivete. In this story, three males were on trial for the rape of a classmate. During the trial, the defendant's attorney fought for their client's innocence by blaming the victim. It was sickening to me. There was video proof, and they still claimed she consented. The victim was a teenager, a Jane Doe. The defense's victim blaming went so far, they asked the jury why Jane Doe wasn't on trial herself. The evidence overwhelmingly pointed toward guilt, but the jury's deliberation indicated otherwise. The defendants were nearly set free when the jurors became deadlocked. It was only due to a persistent district attorney forcing a second trial did the jury find all three defendants guilty. A couple years after reading the story, I started to evolve into a writer. As I began considering what stories were important for me to tell, I kept returning to that article. So I tried to write the play. I had never written a play before and predictably failed. I just wasn't equipped to take on something so, I don't know, awful and true. Every couple years I returned to it, thinking that was the time I could tell the story. With each attempt, I struggled to even complete a draft, tossing it in the proverbial drawer each time. I kept thinking about the intersection of good and evil and toxic masculinity before I had even heard the term. Where does that behavior come from? How does it happen that an innocent newborn can grow into a horrible person? Why do my female friends need to worry about their safety when attending a party, and all I need to consider is how to get home later? Over the years, I ended up writing plays about many things I can't fully comprehend: war, debilitating illness, domestic terrorism, time travel, and homelessness. I pushed this story aside, but it kept circling and circling. So about a year ago, I gave it another try. During the process, I had a conversation with a director I admired and hoped to work with. She told me something simple, that I was writing a play around a character I could in no way understand. She read the draft and noticed it was the males I clearly understood, and that is where my particular take on the story should focus. It was a simple comment, but a revelation for me. I finally wrote that play and felt for the first time I had a solid first draft. And then, a few weeks ago, over coffee, a person I just met asked what I was working on. I told them about the news article I read over a decade ago and how it led me on this journey. And she said something I can't shake. What does it say about you that a story like that inspires you to write a play? Our conversation was effectively over, and I was left questioning my own morality. Am I a bad person because I feel an urge to write about bad people doing bad things? Soon after this conversation, the stories about Weinstein came out. Hashtag MeToo was ignited. Articles on HowlRound and in American theater began to flow. If I stay in my lane, what do I write about? The community seemed to be telling me this is not my story to write. I am not the person the theater needs to hear from on this. And I want to let it go, and I'm trying, but there is this slice of humanity I understand. I think there is value in telling a story about it. So, Now I'm stuck between listening to the community and following my own internal compass. And there's this play sitting on the edge of my desk, halfway back in the drawer. Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Subtext. My name is Brian James Polak, and I am the host of this podcast. For many of you, this is a welcome back, and for some of you, this might be your first time hearing an episode. If you are interested in listening to playwrights talk to playwrights, you are in the right place. The Subtext has been on hiatus since last spring, and lots has happened since the last episode. I left Los Angeles and moved to Chicago. The podcast, which was previously presented by LA Stage Alliance, is now being presented to you by American Theater Magazine, which is a publication of Theater Communications Group. I've done 25 of these episodes, which you can find in the archives on iTunes if you search At This Stage, The Subtext. There are so many amazing interviews with incredible playwrights. Each is a sort of time capsule for the writers being interviewed. I want to thank LA Stage Alliance for launching this podcast back in 2015. It was the brainchild of Danny Oliver and has become one of my favorite things to do. This episode is a great example why I love it so much. I got to speak with playwright Antoinette Nwandu, author of Passover, Breach, Flat Sam, and others. She has won multiple awards, including the 2017-18 Paula Vogel Playwriting Award presented by the Vineyard Theater. Here is my chat with the excellent Antoinette Nwandu.
Just trying to get their stuff together, and they're like, I don't know who I am,
right?
Not like I don't even know what it means to have a voice,
yeah.
But
I'm just here.
I feel like being a playwright might be my thing,
yeah.
Maybe that's my student. Like that's who I'm perfectly.
That's so awesome.
I'm good for, and that's what I'm hoping to connect with.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, when I quit teaching at BMCC, then I I was the writer in residence at Muhlenberg College, even though I wasn't in residence. And I taught, it was an upper level playwriting course, but it was still just so much better. Like 7 kids, everybody's enthusiastic, everybody wants to be there.
Yeah.
it was a dream.
Yeah.
After BMCC, which was like, you know, the class is supposed to be 27, every class is maxed out at 35.
Oh, that's so many students.
Like, it's so many students, and just...
And if it's a writing class, too.
Right, yeah, just have to, like, you know, and there's no grad school, so there's no TAs, so you do all your own grading.
Yeah.
It was a lot. It was a slog. Like, I started out doing it part-time, but then, like, I got offered a non-tenure full-time position,
uh-huh.
And just, like, the money was too good. Like, it wasn't good enough to be amazing, but it was after just being an adjunct for so long.
Yeah.
To just have a little bit of money that I didn't have to worry about stuff was mm-hmm. great. But, yeah, no, my writing took a huge... Because, like, the emotional labor of teaching, it's like, yeah, to do for more than one class, it's like you can't... Then you have nothing left for the page. You just have nothing left.
Yeah.
So it was intense, and then I kind of just, like, burnt out, and my play Passover was getting a workshop at Cherry Lane, and there was this, like, huge miscommunication about, like, whether or not I could take time, because it was happening during
my teaching. Oh, so this wasn't that long ago.
No, oh my gosh, this was April 2016.
Okay,
And there was this, like, big miscommunication with, like, the head of my department, because, like, I was teaching, and then I got a sub. Because, like, my show was going up at Cherry Lane, and I was like, I'm not gonna... This is, like, you know, the first taste of some sort of a big break, and her boss got word that I was, like, taking... I was taking more time. I was taking, like, 3 weeks off for, like, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then the boss was like, you either come back to class now or you're fired, in this really douchey chain email with, like, all these other people in it. And then I was like, I'm sending in my resignation. And literally it was, like, not a premeditated. I mean, that's not true. Like I had been hoping and dreaming for, like, the 3 years prior that, like, at some point I would be able to walk away. But I definitely did not go into that production thinking, like, now I'm going to walk away. But, like, he was just such a douche and such an asshole that I was just like, well... I'm leaving.
So it's such a leap of faith. Like, where were you sort of mentally around, oh, wait, there are bills to be paid, there's health insurance,
totally.
There's that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I had stored up a really, really great, just, like, savings account. Like, mm-hmm. it's definitely, I mean, it was great for me. It, on paper, was not a financially sound or wise decision. In the sense of, like, you should never be living off your savings. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
But I did, and it was a huge leap of faith. And literally, I got the contract money for Passover came as that last money was ending. So it was just, I mean, like, and now I'm things are great. Like, commissions are rolling in and things are happening. Like, Passover happened over the summer, which was great. But yeah, it wasn't at all assured.
Well, look, we're recording, by the way.
Oh, we are? Okay. Yeah.
Hi, everybody.
I do all that welcome
stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You like...
yeah, later. We'll nip and tuck and all that kind
awesome.
Of
stuff. Awesome.
So I want to go back.
Okay.
I want to go back and get an idea. This is good. We'll reach that recent history and then fill in later. But I'm interested to learn a little bit about where you grew up and where you grew up and how it relates to your journey to become a writer.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, actually, I grew up in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And I did not know that I was going to go into theater. Theater was not a substantive part of my...
Which is true for most people.
Do you think so? I mean, I feel like in New York you meet all the people who are like, and then my parents took me to Broadway when I was six.
No, I mean, like, in Los Angeles, though.
Oh, yeah, no, in Los Angeles,
because,
true.
Because what I learned was I got into theater in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And I was doing some acting, and then I started to do a little bit of writing, but I wasn't into theater.
Right.
And then I moved to Los Angeles and really got into theater. And every time I would mention that to people,
people would be like, "What?
Wait, how does you got into theater in LA?"
Right. Right.
And because LA has such an unwarranted bad rep for bad theater. Because there's a lot of really amazing stuff, but people don't go there for
that. Right. It's not a theater town.
Yeah, exactly.
In that sense of, like, identity. Yeah.
So you're growing up, you weren't connected to...
I was not connected to the theater. I mean, you know, a few friends in school productions once in a while that I maybe saw or didn't. But... And also, no real understanding. I mean, I knew I loved words, I knew I loved language, I knew I loved books, I knew I was going to be an English major when I went to college... But no real sense that that could lead to any sort of a career path.
What did being an English major mean to you when you were a young person?
It meant learning how to think and learning how to... I always feel like when I'm reading, I am getting inside of the mind of another person and learning how to just, like, be in the mind of another person and how to... translate these really murky feelings into something that is precise and something that's communicable and easy to communicate.
Right, yeah.
Not a communicable disease. My thoughts are not diseases. Yeah, and sort of, you know, coming from a background and a home life that was high, intense emotions and not a lot of straightforward communications about what those emotions meant, that, like, when you encounter a well-written sentence and you know exactly the emotions that that person is feeling or exactly their point of view on something, that was just thrilling for me in a really basic way. It was, I do think that a lot of my first encounters with books were, like, proto-therapy in the sense of, like, oh, that person is having, like, you know, Heathcliff on the Moor is, like, they're having those emotions, but they're also, like... able to shape them into these words so that I can completely understand what those emotions mean. And you don't have to just feel like you're this mass of feeling that has no shape.
Yeah.
Which is how I think I felt a lot of times as a kid.
And were you ever intellectualizing it? Like, how did the author achieve this emotional...
Not at the beginning, not until, like, college makes you intellectualize it. I think at the beginning it was just a sense of awe and a sense of wanting to have sort of kismet relationships with people that I had no business knowing about or understanding. Mm-hmm. Also, I did grow up in church, in a very strict and serious church background. So the idea of text as authority was very, you know, the groundwork was laid for me to be someone who, I love close reading. I love textual analysis because, like, I mean, I grew up in a church where, like, that's all of our, like, once I realized that, oh, every sermon I've ever heard is just a close reading of this text, I was like, oh, I know how to do this.
Yeah.
I totally get what this is. And also the sense that, like, you know, the church background gives you this, like, oh, no, close reading so that I can figure out how to live. This isn't just, like, some academic thing. It's like, there's this person standing in a pulpit saying, like, and now we're going to apply this to our lives so that we can be good people. So I feel like the groundwork was really laid for me.
And church can be so theatrical,
too. Oh, my gosh.
So you're learning, yes, without even realizing you're learning about theatrics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the pageantry of the whole thing and sort of the emotional release and sort of, you know, being in a space where the space that is built for catharsis and built for transformation, mm-hmm, and built for, like, self-reflection. It was sort of the whole package in its own crazy way. It was the whole theatrical package,
mm-hmm,
I feel. So, yeah.
So I'm curious if there's if you are as connected to your religion as you were when you were growing up. Like, is this still a big part of your life?
You know, it's really interesting. Around the time that I stopped teaching, a little bit before that, I actually stepped away from the church community that I had been a part of for pretty much my whole time in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you do a big sort of, like, look at my life, and I realized this a little while ago. So as a kid, you know, no choice, go to church every Sunday, and usually on Wednesdays as well, like, at least two times a week in church. And then at 18, I went to college, and I was like, woo, choice,
right,
brunch,
right,
alcohol, like, I don't have to do any of these things. And so for actually all of college, and then 3 years after that, I was just sort of free in the wind, doing nothing, and kind of purposefully not thinking about, you know, my spiritual life, just sort of relishing being a young adult and all that that brought with it. And then when I turned 25, there was a real sense both of, you know, I don't really have a framework for how to live. I'm someone who grew up in a community that did provide a framework for how to live. And then there was also just that sort of panic of, like, at that point I was already in New York and feeling aimless and not feeling like I understood, how to be a person in a responsible, adult kind of way. And so the only, you know, it wasn't even really a choice so much as, like, okay, I know that a church community can be a really great place to do that. And so I sort of tentatively found a church and then became a really active member in that church and was for about, let's see, from 25 to, so yeah, so for about 9 years I was. And the way that I look at it now, and I'm still processing it because it's all still pretty
yeah,
fresh.
Yeah.
The way that I'm processing it is that, like, you know, I needed a nest. I needed a home. I needed a space to belong, and I needed an identity. And then within the last 2, 3, 4 years that I was there, that identity began to chafe. Mm-hmm. And that space definitely began to chafe, and some of the more conservative beliefs, some of the political beliefs, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes this thing of, like, okay, everybody needs family, everybody needs identity, and that's so wonderful and loving, but if you're constantly grumbling in your spirit, if you're constantly like, I don't agree with this, I don't agree with the way this is happening, I don't agree with what is being said right now. For me, growing up in a very conservative church where the general party line is to be suspicious at best and downright confrontational with culture,
mm-hmm,
and with, you know, with definitely with popular culture, you know, art and anything that is humanistic or anything that, you know, strikes, you know, of something that is secular, a secular humanist artistic view of the world is mm-hmm. Is very shunned.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I was, you know, because I started NYU, my MFA at 26, and I was still at that point very, very active in the church. And there was, you know, when I was at NYU, I felt like I was in this group that was very suspicious of religion and very suspicious of, like, oh my gosh, like, you pray, you read a Bible, what is that? That's so crazy. That's so archaic. And then when I was in the church, people come up to me like, oh my gosh, you know, you're with those people that are so liberal. And so it was like these two groups that that each wanted allegiance.
Were you feeling judged on both ends?
I a little bit. I think that, I mean, yes, and I think my biggest judge is myself. Really? I internalized that stuff so easily and so well that there was just this somewhat neurotic voice that was constantly just like, am I doing this well enough?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this passion inside of you that wants to follow that thing, and but if I follow that thing too much, will I lose this thing? And so, in August of 2014, without knowing what the future held, I was like, I need to take a break. And there had been a few other times, you know, once in my late 20s, and once also in my early 30s, where I was like, I think I need to take a break, but I kind of didn't have the balls to do it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and everybody is obviously saying, like, no, don't, you know, like, this, it's a bump in the road, your faith needs to be cultivated. And
mm-hmm.
you know, also just having an identity, you know, having a leadership position and being someone who was viewed as a leader and a pillar of a community is actually a very satisfying and wonderful identity.
Yeah.
To have and to cultivate.
Everything you're saying, because I'm a non-religious person,
mm-hmm.
all the things that you're saying are the reasons why I want to be in the theater.
Yeah.
But the difference totally. Between the theater and most churches, not all churches,
mm-hmm.
but most churches, is I could choose to go to church and I would be in church
mm-hmm.
and I could be there every Sunday and I could be attending these things. In theater, if I want to be a participant, not
uh-huh.
an audience member, you need to be invited in, right?
So I'm seeking
that to be part of that thing,
yeah.
The community, the togetherness, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'm knocking on doors to
try to be invited
to figure
into...
out which is the one that is for me, you know?
Yeah.
I
hear that.
But I keep connect, like, everything you're saying about your religious journey in and out of the church is,
mm-hmm.
I keep thinking, oh my God, that's what's been motivating me to
totally.
Do. Yeah.
And there are, I do think that there are a lot of parallels. Again, I mean, when I did leave, there was a lot of, you know, there was some pain that I was carrying
mm-hmm.
and still some processing that I need to do. And so now I think I'm in a place where, you know, my boyfriend has a really lovely church down in Austin and that I visit sometime. But, I mean, the relationship is so different. There's not this pressure to be there every week or anything like that. It's, like, super, super chill.
Mm-hmm.
Also, their politics are a lot more liberal, which
mm-hmm.
is really exciting for me
mm-hmm.
to see a church that embraces love in a way that is a lot more inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, this is actually really great. And these are people who genuinely have a love for Jesus that I don't feel I can or should judge in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
But I do think that a lot of the identity and the sense of community and also a sense of purpose, you know what I mean? We're a community that's not based on religious that's not based on cultural background or where we're from or even education or whatever. We're all sort of like-minded in a way that we want to make ourselves and therefore our community and our lives better through this activity.
Right.
You know what I mean? Through this
right.
thing that we do, whether it's in the theater, okay, we're going to make this show, or, you know, in the church, okay, we're going to either say this prayer or sing
yeah.
this song or do this good deed or whatever. So there, I do think there are a lot of parallels.
So jumping back a little bit, as you're growing up in Los Angeles and, Your family would be attending this church, and
mm-hmm.
you were yearning to be an English major, right when you go away to college.
Yeah.
What did you start writing in this period?
No, I didn't actually. You know, it's really interesting. I in college I struggled a lot with, and I still struggle with, realizing the difference between what it is I want, mm-hmm. and the passions that I have, and what it is I think either society or my family or some internalized superego needs for me to do. So I was pre-med for the first 3 semesters of college, and I was at Harvard, so, I mean, it was no joke. Like, these people were crazy, and I was, like, not doing well in these classes at all, super unhappy, but still, like, you know, my best and worst quality is my stubbornness, and so I can run headlong into a brick wall for a really long time. And so, you know, just that sense of, like, oh, Antoinette, you're not enjoying this. Like, you don't like this. It took actually a few professors and, you know, a little bit of time for me to finally break out and say, like, no, I can't try to balance this thing that I don't like, but that I think people want me to do.
Was it a practical choice going in?
I think it was practical. It was partially practical, and it was also partially, you know, getting so much great feedback from people when, you know, when you're in high school and you say, like, you're like the black scholarship kid at, like, a really rich school, and you say, like, oh, yeah, I want to be a doctor. People are just like, oh, my God, that's amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's so great.
Yeah.
Also, I do think there was this sense of responsibility because, you know, everybody knows I know what a doctor is. I know the doctors make a good living. I could, you know, help my family in a way that in the theater you're not always sure you're going to be able to do
right.
or anything. You know what I mean? So there were a lot of practical reasons why it fit, except for the fact that I had no desire whatsoever to actually do this. So then I backed away, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to be an English major, and then I'll be a professor, because, again, that's something that I could visualize, and that's
mm-hmm.
something that I understood.
Mm-hmm.
And I held on to that until the year after college, I got a 1-year master's degree in Scotland,
mm-hmm.
which was sort of like a really structured way for me to just go abroad and to live abroad, which was so cool and amazing. And I, like, right when I got there, it was like, okay, now apply to PhD programs. And it was in that application process that I kind of broke down and was like, oh God, that feeling again, like, I don't want to be a professor. Academia is so, I mean, I love it, and I love what it has brought into my life. You know, the close reading and all that stuff, but I was just like, it's so, the ivory tower, it's so far removed from real life and from what people want to do. And so it was sort of like a little bit junior year, definitely senior year of college, and then definitely that year in Edinburgh where I mean, it was so sad and pathetic, but I would like try to write these little, I had no sense of process.
Right.
I had no sense of my voice, anything. It was, again, just knowing that, like, I have read literature where people had what seemed like earth-shattering feelings that they have gotten on the page. And, like, I am sitting here and I'm having what feel like earth-shattering feelings and then trying to put something on the page and coming up against a deep sense of shame, a really deep sense of discomfort with objectifying those feelings in a way.
Shame and where was the shame coming from?
I think in holding myself up as an object. Is
okay.
Shame, I would describe those early attempts. I would describe the shame that I felt during those early attempts. This is going to sound a little weird. Very similar to the shame that I felt the first time I took a selfie. Like the very first
yeah.
time when I was just like, what am I holding, you know what I mean? Holding a camera up to myself and then I'm going to, what, post this somewhere? You know what I mean? Because I'm right at that age where, like, I remember a pre-digital world. And, and the sense of narcissism and, again, that superego, like, oh, you're going to just focus on yourself. Like, what is this? Like, you need to be out helping other people. You need to be doing whatever. So, not really realizing at that point that, A, that what I'm feeling is probably very close to what a lot of other people are feeling. So focusing on myself is focusing on other people. That there is a way to do it in, that's narcissistic, but then there's also a way to do it that is transformative and that allows you to understand other people better. So not really having a sense of that and just feeling deep frustration, obviously, with the process coupled with this. Now I can laugh at it, but at the time it was actually really crippling, this crippling need for, like, instant perfection.
And what form were you writing in when you, in these early...
Poems, a little bit, and plays. I mean, I wrote a few very short, kind of cryptic plays that I would then destroy.
That's funny.
Yeah, because I was just like, oh my god, I got it out. And then I would just be like, ah! Or I would, you know, would delete them. And they were all really, like, bordering on surrealist, kind of weird psychodramas.
Where was this coming from? Did you have a relationship with the theater at this point?
No.
So what in your head said...
I mean, I definitely had started reading plays, like, junior year and senior year of college.
Looking at them
as literature. Yeah. And, you know, just as an English major, just being like, oh my gosh, there's something about theater. And I was always a very dedicated audience member for Friends. I had, you know, a roommate that would act once in a while and blah, blah, blah. And so, again, it wasn't like, oh my gosh, the theater yet. But it was like, okay, I know what this is, sort of. And I've read these plays. I studied with Adrienne Kennedy at Harvard. And so she gave us just like this laundry list of amazing plays. And so that was a deep dive in, you know what I mean? And then I was just like, oh, I think I can... This idea of people talking was very attractive to me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I just started trying to put something down. And then the blessing of being in Scotland, once I was, like, had my second, like, oh, my gosh, I'm not going to be a professor, I don't think, what am I going to do? I had done some journalism in college, and that was when I was like, okay, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is happening, I'm going to get a job as a theater critic so that I can just see as much theater as possible.
That's brilliant.
And yeah, because it's like, I cannot pay for tickets.
Right,
so
yeah.
How do you get free theater tickets? And criticism, I actually took to it really, really well. And then after that, I landed in New York, and that was sort of what I was doing. I was teaching expository writing at NYU because I had technically a master's degree, and a friend of mine, a dear friend, hooked me up with that job. And then on the side, I was reviewing off Broadway plays and just trying to, like, get myself into this world. Like, I knew nothing, didn't know my ass from my elbow.
Because you're
trying
to figure out your own voice at the same time.
Yeah, and just trying to figure out, like, what is this thing? Why do I, even if the play is really, really bad, why do I feel super captivated in this space? And not yet, I think at that point, not yet piecing it together also with, like, oh, you're also a person that had grown up in church, so there is something very natural about, like, sitting with other people and listening and receiving a message.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very, very natural and actually kind of very comforting about that space for me. So I think I was looking and I was searching for, like, what is this? How do you do this? And then thinking about theater criticism as a profession. And I sort of had this really terrible job interview with Brian Cody. Is that how you say his last name? I don't know. When he was still at Time Out New York. The job that Helen Shaw now has, and she does an amazing job. And I was the sort of, like, pity interview that went nowhere. And it was around that time that I got some feedback from a few people about my writing, that if I wanted to take theater criticism seriously, I needed to get sharper, I needed to get meaner, I needed to speak to the audience, because the consensus was that I was speaking to the artists and essentially attempting to cultivate. Like, my whole thought was, if this person is serious, they're going to make another piece of art. I want to help their next piece of art get better.
And you're also, maybe unaware of it, an artist yourself.
Well, that was
right?
the thing. Yeah. And that was the sort of light bulb moment when everybody was like, well, this is what you need to do if you want to take the theater criticism seriously. And I was just like, I can't live that way, tearing people down. You know what I mean? Like, what they're asking you to do.
They literally say you need to be meaner.
Yeah.
They use that word.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was reviewing so much off Broadway that, like, was honestly, like, kind of terrible.
Yeah.
And, like, but with kid gloves trying to, like, but that one lighting change was, you know what I mean? And, like, let's move. And it's just like, no, if it's not working, like, come on. Be, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And the idea also of, like, if people are paying money to see this, they're counting on you to tell them, don't go see it.
Right.
And I just,
yeah.
I understood that, I guess, as an approach, but I was just like, gosh, what a life. I don't want to do that. And then that's when sort of, like, 2 + 2 started to equal 4, and I was like, oh, maybe I'm talking to the artist because I want to be...
And was there, do you recall if there was a moment? Was there an aha light bulb?
Or was I don't
it just
think
like
there was
slowly...
a specific moment. It, I mean, like, it was a slow seeping in, even starting with just wanting to read plays
mm-hmm.
in college. I do think, though, I was hanging around people. As I was teaching at NYU, I was actually teaching the Xboz class with Raju Joseph, who obviously knew exactly what he was doing and what he was up to. And so I think hanging around with people who were doing it, seeing plays and, like, wanting to, you know, feeling like you're outside of the ring and wanting to jump into the ring,
mm-hmm.
but still sort of not really understanding what that meant for, like, a career.
Was this when he was a playwright, or is this before when
Yeah. He was, I remember, I don't know if Rajiv ever listens to this. This is my apocryphal Rajiv Joseph story. And I do remember this. We were teaching, and it was one afternoon, and I remember in New York, they would give you those free Metro papers. They don't really do them anymore, but they're like these free little...
daily newspapers.
Yeah. And I remember when he was like, I saw a story in one of those free rags about a tiger, because it was during the Bush... Iraq war or whatever, and he was like, about a tiger in a zoo in Baghdad. And like, and then for me, like, several years later, to be sitting on Broadway watching that play was just like, I was just, you know what I mean? That moment of like, I don't know how you do it, but like, I know him, he's teaching, I'm teaching, he had an idea, and now there's a play.
Right.
And Robin Williams is in it. And it's a beautiful play about deep philosophical topics. Super topical, super funny, beautiful. And that was definitely one of the moments as an audience member and as a witness, really,
mm-hmm.
of somebody, like, crafting something. Where I was just like, well, that's the bee's knees. That's everything. You know what I mean? That's that. Like, I don't know how it happened, but I got to jump into that.
Yeah.
I think it was a huge part of just like being around people who it seemed like, yes, this is what I want to do. And also just sort of like those internal rumblings. So, yeah.
And is that the thing that triggered you to say, I want to get my MFA? Or did you start to work on your craft before that?
No, I didn't work on my craft before that. I wish I had now. Hindsight, of course, is 2020. So yeah, right after I kind of had those mini light bulb moments of like, okay, I think I want to try to do this. Then I applied to grad school and got in on my second try. And it was like, again, like, no real understanding of craft or any of that on my own. And so it was like, oh, I'm going to apply to grad school, and when I get to grad school, somebody's going to teach me how to write. And then I get to grad school with people who knew how to write.
Oh, yeah?
And grad school was hard. Like, I'm not even going to lie. It was super, super hard because I was, like, way too early. I think I went there way too early. I think I had all kinds of, like, unformed instinct.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't know how to channel. I had no understanding of, like, I think I also still approached it very earnestly as a student. So when people would give notes and feedback, I would, like, take them all and
mm-hmm.
go a little schizophrenic and then,
mm-hmm.
like, shut down and not write.
Because
I was just like, everybody's telling me what to do. I've got to do all these things. So no understanding of, like, the authority of my own voice and of my own instinct. No understanding really of my process.
And that's how those are your feelings going in?
No, that's like in hindsight looking back. Going in, it was just like deer in headlights, like, I'm here, I love the validation that I've gotten in.
Right, yeah.
And everybody else seems like they know what they're doing. Right. And I do not.
It seems like there were three types of grad students, particularly in the playwriting world. Those who are going to grad school too early, mm-hmm. and are probably ready for grad school upon graduation.
Yes.
Those people who are primed, ready,
know exactly what they're doing at the right time,
and then those people who are just beyond.
Yeah.
Who probably shouldn't be wasting their time and money.
In grad school. Yeah, no, who are kind of just there for the paper. And the validation that that brings. Yeah, I was definitely...
Now, in retrospect, do you feel like, after having gone through this process and getting your MFA, that it was the wrong time for you?
Oh, it was definitely the wrong time. It was. In fact, I knew, I could feel, about 2 or 3 years later, I was like, oh, this is when I should have gone.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What was it? Was it your voice?
It was voice. It was honestly just confidence and assurance in your process. And an understanding of what it is that compels you to write. Like, what are the problems that you're working out? What are the things that you want to do? Yeah, so that when you get to grad school, you're not going to be that sort of rudderless boat that's mm-hmm. kind of going with everybody. Like, when I got out, when I finished grad school, you know, whatever that little flame of intuition and trusting my gut... And just sort of, I don't know if it's talent or, you know, or just, again, stubbornness, that flame was so low. Mm-hmm. And I had been, like, so hard on myself and so just having these sort of wildly unrealistic expectations that it took 3 or 4 years of just me, like, I honestly feel like the years after grad school were kind of my real grad school, where it was just like, okay... Nobody, you know, I'm sending these plays out. They're being rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares. I got to sit here and figure out who I am and why I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's when I started having the experiences also of, like, oh, even when I'm teaching, even when the bills are getting paid some other way, I'm still enjoying sitting and figuring out this process and figuring out the craft and figuring out how to do it. And that's when it felt like... Okay, this is starting to... I mean, it was hard. It was one of the hardest periods of my life.
Was there a play that you started to work on where you were actively feeling like it's coming together now?
No. I don't feel like it's come together for me yet. Does that sound weird?
To me, it seems totally weird because I look at you and I'm like, this person's got their shit together. They know exactly what they're doing.
I have fooled yet another one. I don't think of myself that way. And I don't think of my plays... Well, A, I don't think I've written... I am deeply self-conscious about, like, the number of plays I feel like I've written, which is, like, kind of zero. Like, I am writing, like, 4 plays. Like, I don't think of Passover as done. And this is my own neuroses.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So when people are like, how many plays have you written? And I'm just like, you tell me. I don't know. So, yes, sure. I am better at my craft now than I was then.
Well, was there something about your relationship to subject or to characters? Like, was there something where you started to be like, I am figuring out how I write?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, I've had so far a few watershed moments. The first one, I was working on a play of mine called Flat Sam at... Wordbridge, which is a play development program that I think no longer exists, unfortunately. And I remember a watershed moment of realizing the difference between talking and dialogue, and that I liked dialogue that was poetic. I am not a writer who is attempting to capture the way people talk in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm attempting to defamiliarize the way people talk so that the language is poetic and strange. And something condensed and supercharged. You know what I mean? How can I say the most with the fewest words in a way that is, feels like everyday poetry, in a way that has a certain cadence and a certain rhythm that is not just people talking? And so that was a huge watershed moment for me where I was like, oh, dialogue for me is something that is much more crafted and much more succinct.
How did you, I'm wondering if you can harken back to that sort of self-discovery. Was it on the page where you were realizing this? Was it in the rehearsal? Were you working with an actor?
I mean, I was working with actors. It was definitely, let's see. Yeah, we had a full acting company, but it was on the page. And it was, I mean, part of the thing about my process that has gotten healthier is that I'm not as neurotic, again, about end goals. And so it was kind of a forging in the furnace moment, because I was just so focused on just like the words on the page. And I remember just getting to a place where I couldn't really understand what was going on. I still didn't have a very clear understanding of plot or of plotting, which is something I think that I'm digging into now. But I remember just like doing a page one rewrite in that process because I was bored with the words that the characters were saying. And it kind of was this like, you know, like I don't think I was eating enough or sleeping enough. And it was this sort of like dark night of the soul thing where the version of the play that exists now, I remember just sort of giving myself that task of like, how can I get them to say as much as they need to say with as few words as possible? And also really accepting the fact that I had this drumbeat rhythm that I wanted to impose on the language, that I had been afraid of, like, any time I wrote in a way that imposed this this rhythm on the language, I was like, no, people don't really talk like that. And it was just sort of like, oh, yes, people don't really talk like that, and that's what I want to put on stage. This idea that the writing has to be, like, you know, TV realism or you know, I have to capture the way people really talk. I think that works for some people. That's not what works for me. Mm-hmm. I want it to be a lot more crafted than that. And so it was just like, oh, that thing that I've been trying to push away and say, like, stop doing that. It's actually the whole thing. Like, that's the whole thing.
And there's something beautiful about the way your words are laid out physically on the page. You're communicating to the person working on that play indirectly kind of what you were just explaining. Like,
yeah.
This isn't real. You aren't telling them how to deliver these lines.
Right.
But you are saying, this is not how we talk.
Right. Yes. Yes. Thank you for saying that. I do, you know, sometimes I have a hard time communicating with actors. They're like, why the line breaks? Are you trying to give me breath pauses? And I know some people do that. And I'm like, it's not even really that. It's more like the line breaks are almost psychological.
Yeah.
To tell you that, like, this is a crafted thing, so the person the person is also very crafted, and the world is very crafted, and it hovers somewhere above the ground. These are not people that you're going to walk outside and see necessarily.
Right.
They're like a little more epic.
Yeah. And for me, I try not to be on the nose in my communication to anybody working on my scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love that space,
mm-hmm.
you know, where we are collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like to give answers, but I give indications.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I don't write how you write. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't lay my words on the page the way you lay your words, but I recognize the intention of what you were writing and how it's crafted, and I was very much connecting to that.
Yeah.
So I was like, I get it. I will do it in different ways, but I think I'm trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to say to an actor, and it's hard to articulate. Like. I see, since you're struggling to articulate it, I also struggle to articulate it because I simply just don't want to tell them exactly what I want.
Right.
Because it isn't about exactly what I want.
Right.
It's about somewhere, if you're the actor and I'm the writer, it's mm-hmm. somewhere in between us.
Meeting is, somewhere. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's also about, like, on the page, creating a space where all of the invention and all of the talent and all of the spontaneity that an actor brings will be in service of the same thing. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I feel like if we indicate too little and you're working with an actor who has a great amount of talent, they will fill in the blanks in a way that's like, oh, now you've made something else. And it's like, no. This is the space, or these are, I should say, maybe not the space. These are the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Go crazy within those boundaries. If the work and if the shape of the work can indicate the boundaries, then, like, you can have a ball inside of those mm-hmm. boundaries. Do whatever it is you do. I relish seeing what you will come up with as long as you stay.
And there are super talented actors who can pick up your script and just immediately get it.
Yeah.
And there are super talented actors who it's just too much cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
For them, and it's actually not a reflection on ability.
Oh, yeah,
it's
No, not at all.
This doesn't work in my brain.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, that's really true. That's really true. I do think there's a little bit of a... Yeah, I don't know why I'm thinking of, like, jazz now.
It is musical. You mentioned
jazz,
there's a rhythm to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, there is.
And you
there's
can
a musical,
see...
A musicality.
You can see the rhythm. You can see the want... of the rhythm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great way of saying it. Yeah. It's interesting now with this play that brings me to Chicago Breach, which is a much earlier play that does not have that same shaping. And so I'm in a really interesting conversation with myself.
Because you're coming back to a play having changed.
Right. Having changed who I am. And so... There's one instinct that's like, oh, the whole thing has to be shaped, but that actually doesn't feel correct. It feels... I've actually been reading a lot of Shakespeare because I'm like, oh, I think in this play there are moments when the characters are just talking and then there are moments when they become heightened and poetic. And so I'm trying for the first time to do maybe both on the page. I don't know. I'm still very... I mean, like, we start rehearsal tomorrow, so I'm
very
interested.
And what was your original pass on the play? Was it more straightforward?
Yeah. It was a lot more straightforward. Just like, I'm going to make it look like what I see other people's plays look like when I open them. Some other people's plays look like when I open them. So yeah, it's super interesting to come back to it as somebody who has an opinion about the way things should look on the page now. And where my gut... Like, I was very surprised when it did not feel right to make... every line of dialogue shaped in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because it felt like, oh, well, this is my thing, and so I've got to do my thing. And then it was just like, no, if you're doing it just because it's your thing, then that's useless.
Mm-hmm.
What is the meaning making for this play as you are writing it now? And sort of giving myself the permission to make this old text new
mm-hmm.
for who I am now. You know what I mean? Like, honoring the ethos and the impulses of it originally, but 100% making it.
So what were your original impulses for it? What caused you to write Breach?
I think it was a lot more about... I mean, definitely marking... my impulses were content more than form. Definitely marking my own relationship with myself and whether, you know, my attempts to... wow, I'm getting really tongue-tied about this. What were my original impulses? I think it was literally just trying to mark the movement that I had made as someone who, like I said earlier, did not really like herself, and someone who had sort of, unbeknownst to her, been performing a kind of self, or actually multiple selves, and wanting to bring that performance and the move towards authenticity and towards integrity onto the page. Also, you know, it's a play about a woman who gets pregnant accidentally. And so I still think that that's a play where I live out a version of life that is much closer to many of the women in my family.
Mm-hmm.
All of whom... Like, I have two sisters, and they both have kids, and my mom obviously had kids,
mm-hmm.
lots of kids, and kids early. My brother also is married and has two kids. So I'm like the only sibling now that doesn't have kids, and they're all still in their 20s. Mm. And so I think, you know, I wrote that first draft in my late 20s, and I think there was some part of me that was also like, I'm not going to have a kid right now, but I can have this play mm-hmm. where a woman has a kid and also deals with her crazy mess. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of, and that still exists, and that still very much is the impulse of the play. But then so what's really fun is to now come back as a stronger craftsperson mm-hmm. and say, like, oh, those impulses are wonderful. How can I just juice them a lot mm-hmm. better? So I feel like that's what's going to be happening over the next 3 weeks. Stay tuned.
are there other artists in your family?
Not professionally. No.
Does anybody in your family share your artistic impulses?
You know what? I don't think that... Not in a way that it's... not self-consciously. I come from a very performative family, though. Mm-hmm. But it's just sort of, like, instinctual, like, people standing around telling really funny stories, doing impressions and things like that. So nobody's really... glommed onto that as like a thing to do to make money.
Do you talk about what you do with family?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
There's a common language that there's sort of like a level of understanding.
I guess so. I think so. I mean, yeah. There's definitely a level of understanding and recognition of the work. Yeah, I think so.
Do you as the playwright, the person in the family who hasn't had any children, who has an artistic career, do you feel outside of your family?
In certain ways, yeah, definitely. There are all sorts of markers that I sort of carry with me that make me feel slightly different. I mean, things that have nothing to do with artistry, like just the fact that I have a different last name than the rest of my family because, mm-hmm. like, I have a different father, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, like, I'm, you know, I went away to college, and, like, I went to college, and I, you know, left California, whereas the rest of my family is still very much in California. And then definitely the art thing and sort of going on that path and seeing where it leads. Yeah, it does sort of feel sometimes like it has set me apart mm-hmm. a little bit. It is easy for me, surprise, surprise, to get, like, tragic and maudlin about it. And it's definitely not a tragic thing. I do have the full support of my family. But I do also feel different.
Yeah, I very much feel supported by my family, but nobody has... I don't even know if anybody in my family has seen a play. Like, they don't go to theater.
Right.
It's not an aspect of their lives.
Right.
So it is not an aspect of our relationship.
Interesting.
But it is the biggest part of my life.
Right.
So the biggest part of my life is not part of my relationship to my family members.
Right.
And I am... always so aware of it.
Right. Yeah, it was actually a really special thing this past summer. My sister and my niece were... It was totally random. They were in Chicago for a wedding. I think my sister's brother-in-law was getting married. Now brother-in-law was getting married. And so I got to bring them in randomly for a rehearsal. Mm-hmm. Which was just so great. And then my sister actually ended up coming back. My niece couldn't because she had school, but my sister ended up coming back and actually seeing the show. Mm-hmm. And that feeling of like my family member is seeing a thing that I have made.
And not only that, but just sort of like a weird side angle process glimpse.
Totally. Right. Yeah. Like rehearsal. I'm like, first of all, I was just like, why do you want to sit in rehearsal?
Right.
But also like, oh my gosh, yes, of course you want to sit in rehearsal.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I do. This is what it is. Yeah. And that was super, super fun to be able to share that with them and to sort of open that door. Yeah, and, you know, theater isn't really, like, an organic part of my family's life.
Yeah.
Like, I am the portal to that space.
Right.
So, yeah, there is a sense of distance, I think. But also, you know, distance that can be traversed.
This is a little bit of a shift in gears, but before we're done, I definitely wanted to take some time to talk a little bit about Passover, because I have such a love-hate relationship with Beckett.
Oh, really?
So part of your sort of, like, I'm not sure how you would define it, source material, inspiration, whatever. But, yeah, I love Waiting for Godot, and I hate Waiting for Godot at the same time.
Oh, wow.
I find it to be, I've probably seen 3 or 4 productions, and I've probably read it, like, 3 or 4 times. And, where I am now, I've probably evolved over time with this play, but... I find it to be a joke on the audience. It's sort of like he...
Oh, really?
He is... He's fucking with us.
Really?
Is how I feel about it.
What is the joke? That Godot doesn't come.
That... How long will we...
Are we gonna wait here?
Are we going to do this?
Yeah. Yeah.
While we're watching and judging people who are doing that?
That's interesting.
That's my sort of, like, and I'm sure, like, Beckett scholars would be like, you are an idiot. But that's been my headspace.
Yeah, yeah.
Lately. And I've seen really great productions. Like, totally. Really well. And I know that's not what the play's about.
Right.
I get that, but that's been my headspace. I would sit there, you know, in the second half of the play and go... He's just messing with us. Like, that's what's going on.
That's
so I'm
so
curious
funny.
About your, like, how you connect with that play.
Right.
And what you, if anything, were you intentionally taking as you were working on Passover?
So, yeah. So I, my relationship with Beckett started definitely second half of college. I do think I read before. So I read Beckett's novel trilogy, and that was my senior thesis. And I remember, I think it was Homi Bhabha, the post-colonialist, who gave me my marks. One of my two readers who was like, "So much thought about such a useless text." And I was just like, "Oh." He's like, "Nobody thinks about this text."
That's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. It was just like, "All right, I'll move on." Like, he was like, "If you're gonna go into this in academia, just know that, like, nobody cares about this." So for me, the reason I bring that up is because if you think that he's fucking with you, I mean, like, Godot is literally, like, his sitcom compared to.
Right.
Because by the third novel, The Unnameable, like, there's no essence, there's no body. It's kind of like what he did with his radio plays later in life, just to completely strip away who these people are. So, like, oh my gosh, the fact that there are characters with names who say things, I'm like, oh, that's like... So my relationship with Beckett, though, again, he was the first person I encountered who was doing that thing with language where he was making this uncommunicatable, this thing that is so difficult to communicate, which is partially the anxiety that I feel like every time I am communicating with you, we're not maybe saying the same thing, we're not maybe saying the right thing. This deep feeling of, like, a love for humanity and a desire to connect, coupled with the understanding and, like, kind of the over-awareness that we cannot really connect. And so you're feeling very hermetically sealed off. Like, I always think of Beckett characters as, like, these little specimens in jars who are just trying to press out. And, like, they just want to touch each other.
Yeah.
And they really, really can't. Because they are also so aware of how terrible the world is around them and how crumbling it is.
Right.
So I just... When I first read him, I was just like, oh my gosh, bee's knees. Like, he was just everything to me. I was a super fanatic. And then, you know, went away and did other things. And so when I came back to Passover, it really did start with that spark of feeling, a feeling of wandering and hopelessness. And also, so for me, it was very intentional, but it was also, it's not just Godot. It's the thing about Passover that for me was so, I don't know what that word is, huge, was that it was taking Waiting for Godot, which, if you read it theologically, has a very specific worldview mm-hmm. about man's relationship to anything divine or anything above, mm-hmm. And putting that in conversation with the Exodus story, mm-hmm. which, you know, it has another very different worldview. So for me, it was what happens when I put those two seemingly irreconcilable texts and that feeling that I had as someone who both grew up in church mm-hmm. but also is an English major. It's like, this is the text of my English major self. Mm-hmm. And when I'm reading it, I feel like, oh my gosh, if I'm not an atheist, then like I at least understand atheists best mm-hmm. when I'm reading Beckett. And that makes me feel so ashamed when I'm like reading the Bible. And like, I love the sweeping epic stories of the Old Testament, and they're so weird, and they're so like, and yet there is this, you know, deep strain of hope and love and wandering. But wandering is a little bit absurd. Like, they really did just walk in circles for this, you know, during the Exodus. So it was like, oh my gosh, I have to put these two texts in conversation.
It's almost an inevitable result of you, the writer, and your experiences, right?
That's what it felt like. And it felt like for the first time I was crafting something where I didn't have to leave any part of myself out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that desire to have integrity, not only as a person, but on the page, like, I want to write things that feel like me mm-hmm. and like all parts of me. And yes, I, you know, curse like a sailor and, love Beckett and love, you know, sculpting these things on the page, but also like I have a deep love and relationship and affection for like this biblical text. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was sort of the intentionality of like, I definitely don't think of it as just like, how do I redo Beckett or how do I translate Beckett? But it's like, how do I pour these two texts through the sieve of each other?
It certainly doesn't feel like your take
it's, on
yeah
right
it doesn't
Thank
feel
you.
Like it doesn't
Thank
feel
you.
Like a redo it is it's just it's almost simply dealing with the same kind of feelings same
yeah.
kind of existential feelings.
That was my hope,
but for me I enjoy Passover. I missed the production, so I only was able to read it off the page, but I enjoy Passover more simply because I think it's more for me. I am not particularly intellectual, and I need, so because I'm not, I don't intellectually connect first, I emotionally connect first.
I gotcha.
So when the thing isn't giving me an emotional connection.
And you don't, and Godot doesn't give you emotional connection?
It doesn't.
Interesting.
And I try,
okay.
and
yeah,
I,
yeah, yeah,
I
yeah.
go, I go wide open.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
And it just for some reason.
So yeah, if it's not connecting there, then
so
like,
because
who cares?
I have now studied the work, uh-huh. I will now go see Godot and have a deep intellectual appreciation for it.
Totally,
but I won't end up with an emotional connection to it. Like I will now watch
right.
Godot and then watch turns and
yeah.
And,
yeah.
and phrasing and things of that nature and then I'll watch the craft of the performances and
totally
and appreciate that, but
it's not,
it doesn't hit me, but and then
yeah.
I and so I went into your script with that fear.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I went into
that's
this,
so interesting,
and so I was very moved by it, and
thank
and
you.
So thankfully
right, you're like, oh, it's not that.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
No, that's, I mean, I do get emotionally Lucky's speech when he thinks is
okay. That's actually a good point.
That's just
it's the in the context of it does
yeah.
does hit me a little bit now
and
that
also,
you mentioned that
when they beg
right,
for the bones
yeah.
the chicken bones. But anyway, that's
right.
not. I'm not am not saying that you have to have an emotional relationship
right,
to get
right.
out by any means. But thank you because yeah, I do think that capturing something of that essence. And you know, that's the whole, like, I'm obviously in no way, shape, or form the first person to do that, but that was the whole thing of, like, oh, that feeling exists for people right now. You know what I mean? There are people for whom that thing is a whole thing.
Right.
Is like, so if I can capture that feeling.
Is there, we have to wrap up soon, but I want to ask a little bit, are you intentionally going in and reworking the play before the Lincoln Center?
Yes. Not the plot, like all of the major events will continue to happen as they happen. But it was very clear between Danya and I, once we were up at Steppenwolf, I always felt like I had gotten through 7 of the 10 things I needed to do.
Which isn't bad.
Which isn't bad. No, which, and again, and totally. And so, like, when it opened, I was like, if this thing does, because we did not know Lincoln Center was going to happen, even when we closed. And I was like, look, if this is all it is, I am beyond happy with what it is. Like, if this is the thing that it ends up being. But then wonderfully getting that opportunity to take it and to premiere it in New York, now I have those three other things. And it basically just has to do with just letting it breathe. You know what I mean? Because for better or worse, I am a writer who writes in the rehearsal room. And so it didn't... Nothing clicked until Steppenwolf.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it clicked into place, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a skeleton. It walks. It can do a thing. Like, it's not limping anymore. It's a thing. And now I've just got to, like, let it breathe and let it soak and let some of those moments deepen.
And really, truly, most of the time... The play is ready for its world premiere once its world premiere has
happened. Yeah. It's like, all right. But yeah. I'm excited though, and I'm excited to be working with a lot of the same people and some new people, and it's gonna be fun.
Is there anything new that you're working on at the moment? New writing?
Yeah, I'm.
That's shareable or mentionable?
Ah.
I know some writers have different sort of,
yeah, like... I'm working on this thing. It was supposed to be done. I am now in that group of people that's going to turn in a commission late. So that's the part I'm sharing.
It's a grand tradition of the American theater.
Right. And I was like, no, not me, guys. I keep my deadlines. But the thing still hasn't... I have a draft of it that is boring as anything. And I was just like, well, this isn't it.
Right.
And so I think I know where I'm going with it. I'm not going to be able to talk about it at all. It's about art and social media. And I think it's about call-out culture. And... Yeah.
That's actually a conversation I'd like to have.
Yeah, right?
I'd definitely like to have. Because it's actually an important pendulum swing.
Mm-hmm.
But...
It's hard, though.
It's complicated.
I think it's complicated in general. And then I think because things are moving so quickly...
Mm-hmm.
When I first got this commission, I was so sure that I was going to write a Trumpian retelling of Iphigenia.
Mm.
And I had to stop. Nobody take that idea. I'm still doing it. But I have to do it after he's done. I was just like every day, ten more things.
You can't write about him.
You can't write about him effectively now.
Or you can't write about this administration.
Right. Because it's just like, I don't even know what the damage is.
Isn't that incredible, though?
Yeah.
It's incredible to me. Like, it's just like... We have never seen anything like it.
What is this? What is the damage? What will we survive? I hope so.
I actually had the thought today, as I was reading the news, what would happen to us if... Trump apologized for something.
Like, actually?
What would happen to us as a culture if he had a moment of sincerity?
Like a moment of, like, clarity, sincerity, humanity. That would be so...
I wouldn't... Like,
I know. I feel like we would just be like...
Are we so cynical? Like, I don't know if my cynicism would kick in.
I don't even know if we're cynical. I think we're literally, like, PTSD. Like, we're abused is what it is.
Yeah, that's really it. But anyway, that was my most recent
thought. Would be insane. We would be like, I don't understand.
But anyway, on that note, I want to thank you.
Thank you.
For inviting me into your apartment.
Of course. And, of course.
And taking some time. This was, yeah. It was awesome talking to you.
Awesome talking to you as well. This has been really, really great.
Thanks.
Thank you, Antoinette, for spending some time with me and for being an all-around amazing person. Antoinette's play, Breach, A Manifesto on Race in America Through the Eyes of a Black Girl Recovering from Self-Hate, opens at Victory Gardens in Chicago in February. If you're in Chicago, please go see this play. Tickets can be found at victorygardens.org. If you're in New York City or thereabouts, look for Antoinette's play Passover at Lincoln Center later this year. One other note that we didn't get a chance to talk about. Filmmaker Spike Lee filmed Passover while it was being presented by Steppenwolf in the summer of 2017. Spike Lee's filmed version of Antoinette's play will be opening at Sundance on January 26th. I think it's amazing, and I hope more filmmakers do what Spike Lee has done with Passover and Roger Guinevere Smith's Rodney King solo play. All right, on to the credits. I want to give a tremendous thank you to Rob Weiner-Kent and everybody at American Theater Magazine for taking on the subtext. And an always and forever thank you to Danny Oliver for starting this podcast with me a couple years ago, and to LA Stage Alliance, who is always doing fantastic work promoting and supporting live performance in the city of Los Angeles, a place that will always be close to my heart, no matter how far I move away. I almost always forget to credit the band International Pen Pal for allowing us to use their song for the theme. The band was short-lived, but did record one excellent album that you can find on iTunes. If you want to get in touch, you can send me an email, thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, @subtextpodcast. That's all. Thank you for listening this far. Tune in next month when I share my tips for staying warm this winter. Hint, drink whiskey.